Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For the last 8 years, nearly 350 interviews, Art of the Cut has been talking with the world's best editors in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Today, we're speaking with Louise Ford about editing the Robert Eggers film, The Northman. Louise was nominated for an Independent Spirit Award for Best Editing for her last Robert Eggers film, The Lighthouse. Her filmography also includes features like Bad Education, Wildlife, Don't Breathe, and another Robert Eggers film, The Witch. One of the things that I wanted to talk about with The Northman is just the amount of tension that is in this movie. Can you talk to me about how you build tension as an editor?
It's holding the shot as long as you possibly can. And of course, with Robert Eggers and Jaron Blatchky, the way that they shoot, you know, famously, is a lot of wanners. I mean, it's more than that, obviously. I find it actually quite difficult to intellectualize process because to me, it is 100% intuitive. It's what I feel when I'm watching a performance or if I'm in a scene. I mean, to me, the tensest scene in the whole film is not a wanna. It's between Nicole and Alex, you know, that scene. The tension is in the dialogue in that scene and obviously the performance as well. But also it's an innate timing, like when you make a cut, right? So to take that scene, Alex and Nicole, for example, I'm just trying to feel empathetically the same emotions that those two characters are feeling as they're going through that scene. And therefore, that's what I'm looking for in the performance. You know, I've been asked to talk before. The BFI flew me over to London a few years ago, and it was lovely and it was brilliant. But they wanted me to talk about genre editing, right? Because it was after The Witch. And I find it's like really difficult because it's all about humans and characters and drama. And it doesn't matter whether it's a horror film or a science fiction film or a contemporary, you know, love story. I approach it all exactly the same way, just through human beings. I always come back to, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. In some respects, I've been very lucky with meeting Robert Eggers, meeting Corey Finley, my two main directors that I work with a lot, who are both brilliant writers. There's a choice you make as an editor when you're sent scripts and what you want to work on, you know, and so it's all there on the page, you know. Just go with your gut.
Yeah. In that scene with Nicole, the one that you were just speaking about that was so tense, I would also think that one of the things is that you have to be empathetic to both characters. You need to be thinking, what is he thinking while she's talking? Or what is she thinking while he's talking? And that determines, right, who you're on.
Oh, totally. Yeah, because somebody listening can be more tense, obviously. The words, the impact of the words, you sometimes you want to see the impact of the words on the person that's hearing them more than you want to see the person saying the words. Of course, talking about empathy with, it's interesting to me that, you know, Nicole's character, Guthrun, in this story is, you know, seen as this manipulative Lady Macbeth type character. And to me, maybe as a woman, you know, looking back into the 10th century, she has been a slave. She's been raped. Hell yeah, she's going to be looking out and trying to survive. That's a survivor. She does bad things. Look, she does do bad things. There's no question. But, you know, I don't believe in bad people and good people. We're all good and bad. I think we can all do horrendous things given the correct circumstances, conditions. I don't like to judge. Maybe I have a moral issue, but I don't know.
I don't think so. I think I've heard it said before by multiple people that the villain in the story is the hero of their own story. Like, nobody thinks of themselves as a villain. You have your motivations and you, I'm the hero, you're the villain. You
know? Absolutely, that's it. Well, nobody thinks they're doing things for bad reasons. Let me just say Margaret Thatcher, right? Or George Bush in America. Those, you know, politicians, they're doing things, they genuinely think they're doing the things that are best for the country. I genuinely believe that they both thought that. They weren't, like, trying to, in Thatcher's case, destroy the working class. But I'll get off my soapbox.
Let's talk about the brutality of this film, working with that for so long. It was a pretty brutal and dark film. Do you have to do anything to protect yourself from that? Or did you feel like you knew that it was your job and it was make-believe and that's the end of it?
I get to see the swords bend and prang off, you know, to see that they're rubber. You know, it's not real. I mean, it might be partly my sensibility as well protects me from that. I've got quite a dark sensibility, I suppose. Having said that, I could not watch, you know, people that watch like live operations or something like that. I couldn't watch that. That is too real. I mean, I guess that's it when I think about it. The brutality of this process for me was more about working so hard for so long, because it was, you know, 14 months from beginning to end for me, from the edit. And the violence doesn't faze me because it's not real. And to me, it's not gratuitous. It's telling the story. I've got no interest in ever cutting a horror. I'm not into blood and gore for the sake of it. You know, it's not my bag. You know, some people dig that. That's fine. But I've never watched The Human Centipede. I never want to watch that. You know, I don't want that stuff in my head, you know, or Saw. In fact, maybe Saw's a better example. I don't have never seen Saw. I have no intention of ever seeing it. I don't need to, you know, I don't want to. It's like, I mean, that was a really long answer to your question, but I didn't have a problem.
Talk to me about the chapters. The movie's broken up into these chapters with black screen with this white Norse looking lettering on it. Why use those chapter breaks? And did you try them ever without?
We use them because they're in the script and that's what Robert wants to do. And no, we never tried them without. When you were watching it, were you thinking, I don't think we need these?
No, not at all. I thought that, you know, I liked them. It gave me a sense of what's to come and it gave me a sense of my place in the film. So I was totally good with it.
And it also, you know, it sort of mirrors this, obviously, as an Icelandic saga originally. So if you think about something written down in a book, although I suppose they would have started off just being spoken word, you know, passed down from person to person before they were written down. But I guess it adds a sort of literary kind of, it's a reminder that it's a story.
I didn't realize that this was taken from something.
Yes, it's Saxus Grammaticus. I believe. I mean, it's not a straight lift of the entire story, but it's the same source material that William Shakespeare used for Hamlet, basically, which really amuses me because I think of Shakespeare reading that story, uncle kills father and takes mother, son has to avenge, right? That's the basic structure of the story. But it really amuses me that Shakespeare's sitting there going, Amleth, what can I call it? Oh, I know, I'll just take the H from the end and put it to the front. It's like, dude, I thought you were this crazy writing guy, genius. Can't you think of anything better than that? But it was, I mean, obviously.
Shakespeare is just a thief.
I think it was Jim Jarmusch said, we all steal, but the talent is knowing what to steal.
You've worked with Robert Eggers on The Lighthouse and The Witch and even on a short film called Brothers. How did that relationship begin?
And a short film before that. He did a version of The Telltale Heart.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
The Edgar Allan Poe story, you know, surprise, surprise. I was an assistant editor on a film working with, I'd just like to name check, Michael Taylor, who was my editing mentor. Very fine film editor, narrative film editor. And every day, I mean, this was like what? This would have been 2007. So we were shooting, working on, you know, low budget indie film narrative, shot on 16 mil every day. We had a runner who would take the film to be telecined overnight and then bring the tape to the edit room. And the girl who was bringing the tape, we struck up a conversation, you know, because I was getting the tape every morning, blood from her. And she was producing a short film with, you know, this guy that she'd known. They'd grown up together in this tiny little village called Lee in New Hampshire. Maura Anderson, her name was. And she said, you know, would you want to edit it? And I'm like, yes, I want to edit. You know, I need to edit. I enjoyed being an assistant. You know, there's lots of things that appeal to me, you know, the librarian aspect of it, the perfectionist part of it, all that stuff. But I didn't even train in editing until I was 34, 35. So I didn't have time. You know, I wanted to edit. I didn't want to be an assistant for 15 years. I didn't have time to be an assistant for 15 years. So I wanted to just get out there. So I said, yeah, bring us the script. And she gave me the script for this Telltale Heart. And I was like reading it and just blown away instantly. This guy can write. This is compelling. This is a story I know, we all know, you know. And so I went to meet and I was like, yeah, I want to do this. And I went to meet him and we just hit it off straight away. We both got similar weird interests. Gothy, I suppose, a bit gothy. I was very lucky, you know, I was a kid growing up in the 70s. And in the 70s, you know, my mom we went to the bookshop every week, and she introduced me to a lot of really interesting illustrations, and Brian Froud and like Alan Lee, who did the illustrations for Lord of the Rings, you know. So I was introduced to Victorian book illustrators like Arthur Rackham and Gustave Doré and all this stuff. So I had these as my reference. They're like in my DNA. And my mom used to read a lot of horror books and watch horror films. And I was really into, so, you know, I grew up being into reading and weird shit. And when I met Robert, it's like, bang, you know, the brother from another mother, basically.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting for people that are trying to either get into the industry or understand how they can move up or get a job, that so often it's a personal connection with someone more than it is like, oh, she's going to be the greatest editor in the world. It's like, I am going to relate to her. I feel our tastes are the same. That's much more important.
Oh, God, yes, it so is. It so is. You know, as I mentioned, my husband Andy Ford and Andrew Ford was an avid editor, you know, back in the mid 90s in the UK when I met him. I was working in the magazine industry. I was a journalist, you know. For years, he was saying to me, you know, I'd finish my shift at work. And of course, him being an editor, he'd still be working till like, I don't know, 8, 9 o'clock at night. So I'd finish at my office and then come and sit with him in the edit room. And he would show me the scenes that he was cutting for whatever film he was cutting. And I'd go, oh, why don't you do that? Put that there. I don't understand why he's saying that. So, can we figure that out? And he would always say to me, your notes are really good. Your notes are better than the notes I'm getting from the producer here. So,
yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's lame. I can't just, you know, met this guy, I'm going to marry him. And I'm also going to just do the same job that he does, you know. So I resisted that for years. And also what put me off was the technical aspect. Because to me, it seemed like, oh, it's all tech. I was, by the way, just to be clear, I was very tech savvy in terms of working on a computer because that's, as a journalist, yeah, it wasn't like I was scared of computers or anything, but it was more like I thought that you had to know more about that stuff than you actually need to know. And he was an incredible encouragement to me because whenever I would, you know, when I was being an assistant and I was like, I don't know how to do this, what do I, you know, and he would just be like, you know, you just do the research or whatever. And I said, I can't be an editor because I'll never get my hang of all this stuff. And he was like, being an editor is not about that. You don't need to know all that, you know, like After Effects or all this stuff. Because I didn't really have the interest in that, being super technically proficient. I know I'm interested in knowing what I need to know to enable me to do the storytelling part of the job. Yes, it is very important. And I feel like I'm on a bit of a mission, actually, because I think, you know, traditionally, of course, it's well known that women were the first editors in Hollywood when it was perceived as a kind of a craft like knitting or sewing, I think they used to think of it, right? And then when it became apparent how powerful a tool it was and how important it was to the filmmaking process, men started thinking it's a creative thing. Let's get in on that. And then I think maybe I'm being a gender stereotyping here, but I do think it's a thing. It's particular. Well, people of my generation, women of my generation, anyway, we were shyer about getting involved with equipment and cameras and all that stuff. That, I mean, that's why it took me so long to get around to it. But it was really from encouragement from Andy, just saying, you know, you don't need to know any of that stuff. It's more about human beings and storytelling and empathy and all the other stuff we're talking about.
Which was already in your wheelhouse from being a journalist.
I tell you what I think was really useful for me starting out, being older and starting out in this, was that I had the confidence already. Like my job as a journalist, I was a copy editor, right? So it's kind of doing the same job in a sense. I would get the raw writing from the reporter and my job is then to shape that. And I might have to rewrite the intro and I might have to shape the story so it's got a beginning, middle and an end. And you're doing the same thing as that visually with film, but and also the confidence to make those decisions. I got so used to just like reading somebody's writing, like, no, don't do that. You know, I mean, maybe it's part of my personality too. I don't know, but I was never shy or nervous about making those decisions. And I think that's just naturally something that comes with getting older as well, you know, just being more confident. But I think some assistants maybe feel a bit trepidation about taking that step, but they shouldn't. They should just go with their gut, I always say.
Yeah. I talked to Pam Martin, who just won the Ace Eddie this year. And yeah. she said there are films that I don't think I could have cut or could have cut as well when I was younger. And now that I'm older, I have the experience, not just in editing, but in my life as a human being.
Life. Exactly. Exactly. I think we get better as we get older. Yeah.
Tell me about your collaborative relationship with Robert. And you've worked on these multiple projects. How does that benefit either your editing or how does that benefit him that you've worked on so many projects together?
I know what he likes. He knows that he can rely on me. He trusts my take choice. You know, the directors that I've worked with, you know, I'll put the assembly together. Everybody goes, starts going through it from scene, you know, beginning to the end. So the directors may want to see every take. Or a particular take. I mean, it depends on the, you know, directors, just like editors, directors all work differently as well, I guess. But Robert, a lot of times will not want to change a take, but maybe he'll want to, you know, come out of the scene earlier or things like that. A lot of times he'll just make little adjustments rather than things, you know, he knows what he's got before we sit down. And I know what he likes. And particularly with the long oners, I might have 14 of them. You know, you kind of know instinctively as an editor, it's going to be the last few. That's where they got into the rhythm and they got the shot right and da da da. Which not necessarily mean that you always end up using those there, thinking about it, because performance is obviously the main thing. A lot of times they get caught up with the camera work, like that shot is technically smoother or whatever, but it's not necessarily the best version. I have to say I'm a little bit dismissive of whether a shot's smooth or not. I don't care about that. You know, a lot of times I'm watching a movie and you never know. You look at those movies from the 70s and it's like, and you don't care because the drama is good, the acting's good, whatever.
You pride yourself on having a strong personality and knowing what you like. So not only is it about that you know what he likes, but also sometimes maybe what you need to convince him he should stretch himself or do something differently.
Yeah, and also, you know, with this film particularly, obviously because it's a it's the first time any of us have worked on such a big budget studio movie. Me, Craig, the Lathrop, the production designer, Linda Muir, the costume designer, Jaren, of course, the DP, Rob and I, which is the same crew, key crew, by the way, since The Witch. We've all worked on his films, but none of us worked on anything this big. So I think that Robert, and of course, we want it to be successful. Not the the critics' reviews are great, but and we're very happy that so far they seem to be liking it. So that's great. It's important that it, I feel like there's a weight on this film. It obviously has to be successful at the box office. There's a certain amount of changes we made in during the editing process, stemming from studio notes and test screenings, which we're happy to do, by the way. And in many respects, they made the film a better film, definitely. Yeah, it's painful, but they push you to a place of making the film better, really. I mean, really. I think that Rob relied on us to also be the backstop, if you like, of like, don't do that, Robert. It's not a Robert Eggers film.
So you've edited with him a bunch of times, as we've mentioned. Did you have to edit remotely this time because of COVID?
No, we just had very regular COVID testing, basically. And we took a lot of precautions. So when they were shooting it, nobody was allowed to stand closer than, you know, 2 foot away from each other. You're always wearing a mask unless you're actually shooting, you know, unless you're an actor shooting the scene. Everybody got COVID tested like 3 times a week. My edit crew in, I cut a place called Yellow Moon, just outside of Belfast. Brilliant facility, brilliant people. Yeah, we just wore masks the whole time. So I was in my room wearing a mask. Paolo Bazzetti, my incredible first assistant, was in the next room wearing a mask. We had a second assistant, Jenny. Everybody was just wearing a mask, you know, and we were just very careful. And it's incredible. They shot for 5 months. And most of the crew were local Northern Irish crew, you know, crew who had been trained through like the 8 years of Game of Thrones. You know, these people, you know, they were brilliant. You know, horses, you know, they could deal with all this, the demands of this big historical production. So they live there. So they're going home to their families, right? Every night. For 5 months, we didn't have a case of COVID, which is incredible.
One of the things you mentioned was oners. People might think, oh, this is easy. All you have to do is pick the take and drop it in the timeline and you move on.
And all the editors out there just go laugh and go, yeah, right, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about some of the work that you had to do on some of the oners.
Oh, I mean, so much cheating. So much cheating. Like speeding things up in the, what is it, time warp? Even between dialogue, between pieces of dialogue, loads of speeding things up. The problems that it presents are, obviously, you're backed into a corner. If something's not working, you know, that's why you have to do time warp effects to speed things up.
Split screens?
Oh, God, yeah, comps. A little bit. There was a lot of comps in The Witch. There was one scene in particular with the two little twins and then the goat in the middle. And we're trying to get this one shot. And I remember when the goat was behaving, you know, one of the kids would be like picking their nose. When one kid was behaving and the goat was behaving, the other kid would be like not engaged, you know, because they're little kids, you know. So I think we had to literally use three takes to get the moment where they're all still and doing the thing we want to do all at the same time, you know. I mean, the funny thing is there's the village raid, for example. There are, everybody's going to say that it's like one shot. Of course it's not one shot. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's actually 7 shots, right? But they're just stitched together. But the skill from the camera and the camera crew and the obviously the director, but and also was it Smith, what's he called? Cece, who was the stunt coordinator who helped choreograph that entire raid. Well, didn't help choreograph it. He choreographed it pretty much. The skill involved in that, mega, right? Mega. But still, it's not one take. The difficulties it throws up as an editor is when you're watching, you know, one long take with multiple actors interacting in it and multiple things going on in the background, in the foreground or whatever, nothing, it's never going to be perfect. You know, there's always going to be something that's not quite right, right? So the skill is trying to, I suppose, figuring out what the most important thing is. What can you get away with? What doesn't matter so much? And then it becomes a question of timing when you come in and when you come out of the shot as well, you know?
Was there ever safety coverage for any of the wanders? Or did he just say no?
Yeah, there was one in a reshoot, tiny little reshoot. We shot one shot to enable us, to cut into the wanner, I think. It was like a close-up. And that was the only thing. That's the only time we did that in the whole movie, which is very impressive, I think.
Talk to me about the notes from Robert and what the art of taking a note is. When you get notes from him, how do you feel? What do you do? Which notes do you push back on? How do you push back?
I mean, we're kind of in the room together the entire time. While he was shooting, he would come in, like he'd be shoot Monday to Friday, sometimes 6 days, but mostly Monday to Friday. And then there'd be one day at the weekend where he'd come in and we'd go back and forth. I mean, it's just a discussion. You know, we discuss the performance. We discuss what's going on in the scene, what we should be getting that we're not getting or just something like that. I mean, I'm so collaborative. I know a lot of editors relish the time on their own, you know, and I understand that. Some people love that. The assembly part is my least favorite part. I like it when the director's in the room and we're firing off each other and having, you know, a discussion about things. So I don't have a problem taking notes. As far as notes from the studio or notes from the test screenings, it's that cliched, you know, it's the note behind the note. You'll get a note and it's like, yeah, this doesn't work. We need to cut that out. To me, the skill and the key and what we did a lot on this movie was not, okay, take it at face value. Yeah, that's what we're doing. No, what's the classic note behind the note? Okay, so if that's not working, that thing's not working, that aspect, how do we make that work and keep it in? And Sione, the writer, had this brilliant thing that he said, you know, we'd sometimes be a bit despairing, like, what are we going to do? I don't know. You know, and he's like, look, we're smart, we're creative. If we can't figure out how to do this, we're not working hard enough, basically. It was a lot of that. And that's why I'd say I think that the notes made the film better, because it pushes you, especially when something this big, you know, you inevitably we're all human beings. You sort of get to the point where you're like, I can't think about it anymore. I just don't want to do it. But if you just push that extra inch, you know, you end up coming up with something better, a better version of it, you know. And it's also what Neil Gaiman said as well, talked about taking notes on his writing. You know, you have to remember that when they say that there's something wrong, they're almost always right. And when they tell you how to fix it, they're almost always wrong. You have to figure out how to fix it. I read that and I was like, that's it. That's exactly it. You know, I learned from that, that I'm not going to be, if when I'm asked to screen somebody's film and give notes, you know, so, I mean, I hate that. But very early on, I stopped with the, have you thought about moving this scene there? No, no. All you need to say is, I didn't understand why he picked up that knife at that particular moment. Didn't feel motivated. And then the editor and the director who are sitting there taking your notes, let them figure it out. You know, and they will. They know the best way. They know the best answer. You don't. You're not familiar with the material or anything.
Talk to me about music in this film. What did you temp with, and how do you determine the spotting of a cue when a scene doesn't need music, and where the music should come in if it does need music?
There is a lot of music in this film, as you will have heard. Robin Carolan and Sebastian Gainsbourg, the composers, we were so lucky. They were on from the beginning. Robin's actually British as well. He's back in London now, but he lived in Brooklyn for a few years, 6 or 7 years, ran a record label. Rob met him socially. And so Robin, I have to be specific here, Robin and Robert. Robin, the composer, was already fascinated with Viking instruments, you know, old-fashioned instruments. So it was kind of part of the genesis of this whole project that he was doing the music for it. So I was lucky that I got to temp, basically, with composed pieces from the beginning, which was lovely. Yeah, it was great. Previous films that we've worked on, like The Witch, for example, or Lighthouse, actually. Yeah, we temped with multiple pieces of classical music. Like in The Lighthouse, there's a scene that I think I had like 30 tracks of different pieces of classical music. It's kind of like composing using pieces of completely different things. I can't remember how many pieces he composed for this. There's over 40 pieces of music. It's insane. When you think that he has never scored a movie before, he has never scored a movie before. To go from zero to this massive, epic, big budget studio picture, it's insane that he managed to do it. I think it drove him a little bit nutty. As for how I decide where to put it, in this film, there wasn't much debate about that. I mean, Robert tells me where he wants it. In previous films, when like I said, we've been working more with temp score before we have the composer on, again, you just feel it. You just feel it. I always want to try and sneak it in, you know, so you're not aware of it. And that's the same with my editing as well. You know, I know it's old fashioned. I just don't want you to look at the editing. That scene with Nicole and Alex, my hope is that you're absolutely wrapped by what's happening there and you're just not even thinking about it. I'll probably never win an award for like a Robert Eggers film or anything because I'm just not into that showy editing. I love it in other things. Zola, I think, was one of the best edited movies last year. I think that's Joy McMillan, I think. Yeah, did that. And that's got some really flashy, but that film can stand it. That film demands that, you know.
So the music you kind of got provided as you went from the actual composer. What about sound effects? This is a huge amount of sound, like sword clashes and, I don't know, pigs being slayed or whatever.
Everything. Yeah, there's loads of stuff, animal sounds. Yeah, no, I would cut a scene and then I throw it to my assistant and say, go to town, sword swings, punches, I don't know, whatever, fire. We've got everything in here, fire, wind, rain, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot. And sound to me is so important. I know that doesn't make me unusual as an editor, everybody, but I use sound to make my edits all the time. And dialogue, for example, I did a film called Bad Education with Hugh Jackman and Alison Janney, you know, and they shared a few scenes together. And this is so when, and it was the same with Alex and Nick in The Northman. Their instincts as actors is so good. When I first block out the scene, I'm using their dialogue rhythm. I time it with the dialogue and then I decide where my picture edit's going to be, basically, because they got the rhythm down. So, and then I use sound a lot for like the hard cut. There's a lot of that in The Lighthouse. And probably The Witch, you know. I love a good hard cut on a loud bit of sound.
In your cutting room, what are you monitoring with? LCR or stereo or 5.1?
Stereo, yeah. I did have that. My assistant actually asked me on this one whether I wanted 5.1. I've never used it to offline edit with, and I just felt like it would be too much. You know, we'll do that in the mix stage. I think I saw your Joe Walker when you spoke to Joe, and thinking about it, if you're sitting this close, the 5.1 is not going to really help you.
You cut this in Avid?
Yeah.
Have you tried any other NLEs, or have you always been Avid?
I trained in Final Cut Pro, actually. But the old version, you know, Final Cut 7. And I clung on to it. I cut The Witch on Final Cut 7.
Did you really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that was, 2014, 2015, right? 7 years ago. And when they changed it, they did the big change to 10. I just couldn't get on with that at all. I did a film called Don't Breathe, Fede Alvarez. And that was cutting in LA. And I remember saying to the post-production supervisor, can you find me a Final Cut assistant? And he's like, there aren't any in LA. And I was like, oh. And he goes, I said, but I don't feel confident about doing Avid. I haven't even cut a short in it. And then he said to me, well, you know, a week's worth of dailies, you've cut a short. So I did do a week's intensive Avid training course there before I did that. But on that film, holy cow, yeah. They were shooting, like, talk about contrast to Robert's method. Every shot was multicam on that film. I had edited a little multicam before that, but not like where, like, minimum three cameras. And some scenes were like, you know, six or whatever. I learned Avid cutting that movie, really. It was intense.
I've kept you for quite a while, but I did want to ask about this idea of controlling or molding the temperature of a performance. How do you choose that? And also, as you see the film in context, do you realize that maybe you've made the wrong choice because now you're seeing it over an arc?
All the time. Well, not all the time, but first time you watch the assembly down is when you go, oh shit, yeah, they didn't need to be that angry there. We could have saved that until later on.
Yeah, you tend to go for the emotional, right? The first cut, you're like, oh, I'm going for, oh, there's a great emotional performance. And then you see it in context and you're like, ah, they shouldn't be that emotional.
Being a good feature film editor is all about the macro edit. It's like how you pace and the rhythm and the emotion across the whole movie, you know? It's difficult when you are shooting, you know, obviously most films shoot out sequence, 99% of films shoot out sequence. So you're having to cut a scene towards the end of the movie and you haven't even seen the footage, you haven't even shot the footage from the beginning of the movie, you know. I mean, the script is my Bible. I know some editors say they never look at the script. I can't comprehend how you would cut a movie. Everybody has their own method and that's fine. Me, I get the dailies in. You know, the dailies come in. The first thing I do is read through the scene again and just start cutting. You kind of know, all right, let's say a character's going to have a breakdown in scene 16. So in scene 10, you don't want the massively emotional performance. You've got to save it, right, until then. So it seems pretty logical to me. I suppose it's painful if an actor gives you an amazingly brilliant over-the-top performance, but you can't use it. You know, that's frustrating. I haven't really come across that, actually.
Well, hopefully the actor is also reading the script, realizing that they can't give that performance.
Well, yeah, exactly. Although I do remember my first, like, internship, was on a Jeff Bridges, a movie that Jeff Bridges was in. And I was like, absolutely, I couldn't believe I was allowed in the room to watch the takes, you know. And there was a scene where he had to be on the phone to he was playing a writer who was having writer's block, right? And there was a scene where he's on the phone to his agent and his agent is saying, where's the book, dude? You know, and one take, he played it where he was like angry. And then the next time he's like, I'm doing my best. And then another take where he was just cool and relaxed. And it was amazing to see. It was amazing to watch that, like that an actor that good can just flip like that. You know, Willem Dafoe's like that. Robert would say, not so much on this, but I'll say on The Lighthouse, okay, give us one where you're like gleeful. And he'd go, okay, sure. And he'd just turn it on. Okay, now you're absolutely devastated. He would do it. He could just do it. But I can see why those choices might be useful. But if I haven't been given those choices, might be useful. Yeah. On a more, like, let's say, traditional Hollywood movie where they shoot a lot of coverage. Yeah.
You kind of mentioned how you start to edit on dailies. Can you explain how you watch dailies and then what you do when you've got a blank timeline? Are you cutting from string outs or do you just cut from the clips in the bin? What do you do?
Dailies come in while my assistant is prepping them. The way I approach it is, okay, scene 15, first thing, get to my script notes, right? And then we've got eight takes. What I tend to do is I'll watch three circle takes of each angle. While I'm doing that, you know, that's happening in the morning, my first assistant will be downloading them, putting them all into scene bins, giving them the right titles, la, la, la. But I also like scripting. I rely on scripting. I don't do, it seems to me you either do string outs. I know a lot of editors like the string outs of every line in some cases. I find scripting so efficient for that I don't need a string out. So basically I've watched, say, three circle takes of each angle for that day's shooting. And then by the time that happens, you know, maybe it's lunchtime. And then after lunch, I'll get my daily, you know, I'll get them in the actual Avid. And then I'll watch the other takes. And then I just start cutting.
Did the structure change at all in editing? It sounds like Robert pretty much knows his film, and maybe that didn't happen, but...
Well, interestingly, we did actually, we lost some scenes at the beginning of the movie. It took a while to get there. My instinct quite early on was, this is taking too much time, you know? It's a very delicate and sensitive process, especially if the director's written the script as well. Robert's very happy to be, he's quite ruthless himself with his own material. He never has a problem with getting rid of stuff. But for whatever reason, sometimes you're attached to particular scenes or performances. So it's not so much that we moved stuff around, it's more that we did actually take things out again. And that's normal. Sometimes, you know, you need it on the page, and then when you see the film, of course, you're like, oh, we don't need that scene. All of a sudden it becomes apparent that the information that you thought you needed to get across in that particular scene, you've actually got it from somewhere else already.
And that goes to your point of that the skill of a feature film editor is the macro,
right? Right. I have to watch myself. And I notice in myself sometimes I can get caught up on the little things. You know, I try to remember D.D. Allen's, you know, you don't cut unless you have to cut, you know. I think it was Soderbergh that made that point in an interview I read. Obviously, he storyboards and edits his own movies, so he knows economy and all that stuff. And of course, Thelma Schoonmakers, you know, what is it? Continuities for
sissies. Yeah, we'll say sissies. I was thinking of Thelma when I was watching some of this film because...
Whoa.
Oh, the reason why I was thinking of it is because the classic Thelma quote where somebody said, as a woman, doesn't it offend you or aren't you frightened or something by all the violence in Martin's movies?
Oh, yeah.
And she says, they're not violent until I get done editing them.
True. That is absolutely true. Like I said, you know, I see all the rubbery swords bouncing off and bending and all that. That's all about choosing those moments of most intensity. I'm glad you mentioned that because I love cutting action. I love it. It's literally, it's the most frame accurate cutting that you ever do. It's like literally one frame makes a huge difference to whether it has the impact that you want it to have. Yeah.
100%. And that is a great place to end this interview between the macro and the micro and the frame accurate. We got it all. Louise, thank you so much for this great interview and congratulations on a great film. And I hope it has success at the box office.
Thank you, Steve. And thank you for doing me the honor of interviewing me. I've been listening to your podcast and watching them for years. So thank you.
That's it for Art of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to my guest, Louise Ford. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to our host, Frame.io. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. I'm Steve Hullfish. Thanks for listening.